last Thursday, I think. And, but I mean, like, this whole week, okay. You wouldn't even know it.
Good afternoon. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Thursday, May 21st, 2015. And we are going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 752. Beth, could you provide a brief summary of this bill for us?
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 752 would exempt carbon dioxide emissions from combustion or decomposition of biomass from regulation under certain air pollution laws unless they're necessary to implement the Federal Clean Air Act. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you, Beth. And we have Senator Knope here to talk to us about this bill. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're moving out.
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chairs Johnson and Bearden, and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I am Senator Tim Knope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And Senate Bill 752 is good policy for Oregon. It's actually helpful in terms of jobs. It gives us the opportunity, really, to put Oregon's carbon neutrality policy in place from 2009 to 2014 for carbon dioxide emissions from combustion of biomass into statute. When we started this process in the Senate, the rule had essentially lapsed, and it has now been reinstituted as of April. However, I think it's important that we put this into statute. Washington has a very similar statute, and what we're really looking for is regulatory certainty and recognizing the previous capital investments that have been made by Oregon facilities relying on prior policy for air permitting, climate, and other regulatory programs. This biomass neutrality policy, I think, would help lower Oregon's carbon footprint and stimulate new economic investment. It encourages facilities to combust wood waste rather than placing the byproducts in landfills where wood would ultimately break down and emit methane. I think it recognizes Oregon's unique sustainable supply of biomass from Oregon forest sector that supports all aspects of our economy from rural towns to paper exports in our ports. It also encourages renewable energy generation utilizing residuals from forest management and forest health restoration treatments, reducing wildfire risks and environmental impacts while at the same time displacing fossil fuel energy and carbon emissions. And using our natural resources in a sustainable manner will help keep our forests green and not black. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. And I would note that this came out of both committee and it looks like over the Senate floor without objection. Do you have questions for the Senator? We'll give everybody time to digest for a second. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator, for coming. So just to clarify, we're only talking about CO2 emissions here, obviously.
Yes.
There still are other criteria to deal with particulates and all the other stuff, so none of that would be impacted by this. Any pushback from any sectors? It appears like things are pretty clear sailing in the Senate.
No. As the good chair said, this came out of committee unanimously. It came out of the Senate unanimously. And we've gotten great bipartisan support. And, I think it's just important that the legislature make a statement and give some certainty to the policy itself.
Okay. It does look like we have a couple of letters that were sent to our committee. It doesn't look like they were sent during the time that the bill was before the Senate in opposition to it, but maybe we'll hear from them a little bit later. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I apologize if I missed something. Is there any implication of how this impacts our compliance with the Federal Clean Air Act?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, not that I'm aware of. I suspect there are others that could speak to that more definitively, but not that I'm aware of.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Next, we have Mike Friess and Catherine Van Natta.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, welcome. Go ahead. Whoever wants to start, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Associated Oregon Industries supports Senate Bill 752. We think it's good policy. It's been a longstanding policy, and it is consistent with both state and federal law that supports using carbon-neutral technology to create energy, and it avoids potential and likely expensive regulatory hurdles and permitting that would otherwise be required. So in order to continue to encourage investment in carbon neutral technology, we think this is a good policy, and urge your support.
Thank you.
For the record, Catherine Venata, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We want to thank the sponsors of the bill, Senators Canope and Senator Edwards, for bringing this issue forward. The Northwest Pulp and Paper Association believes this is a very important policy to put into statute because it provides regulatory certainty for facilities. And going forward, it sets the Oregon policy as it relates to the combustion of biomass and the emissions of CO2 and CO2 only. It does not influence any compliance issues with the Federal Clean Air Act. If you look at the bill, it specifies that Oregon's policy does not apply if it is in conflict with the federal law. It's only to the extent allowed by federal law. So there is no conflict. If and when the federal government specifies a biomass carbon accounting framework policy as referenced in the memo that I just distributed from Janet McCabe of EPA, then Oregon, of course, will comply with the federal law. But until this time, this allows Oregon to chart its path for working on air issues and also the 111D rule from the Clean Air Act on the clean power issue. So we would appreciate your support. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Rudin.
Just for clarity, could you clarify for me the source of the biomass that you would anticipate using this?
Chair Pedersen, Representative Reardon, there are various sources of biomass. For a pulp and paper mill, the types of biomass that we are discussing are hog fuel, wood waste residuals that are generated as part of sawmilling activity, and also when our spent pulping liquor that we combust as after we've recycled it many times as part of our pulping process.
Thank you. That's what I expected to hear. I had family that worked in those power plants for many years, and just like normal way of doing business and disposing of the waste, so seemed like a reasonable process.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate you being here. Thank you. Support the policy strongly. Are there potential issues in the near future or sometime in the future if we don't take this action? Could the emissions begin to curtail operations at some potential or existing industries that we have in Oregon or in the Northwest?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think the way to look at it is if for instance, that carbon emissions would be required to go through air quality permitting processes, mm-hmm. I think that that would discourage investment in that type of technology.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the thing to remember is that this doesn't get you out of anything necessarily. What it does is it says, as you account for those CO2 emissions, how are they going to be treated for things like accounting for greenhouse gases? and it encourages the use of biomass because those emissions would not be viewed in the same way as fossil fuel emissions.
Do we have any idea on the, did you have a follow-up?
Go ahead.
Did you have idea on the timeline that the EPA might be going forward with regulations that would impact with? It just seems to me that if we're looking at a situation where they might be doing something sooner rather than later, putting it into statute and then just having to take it out of statute instead of just leaving it in rule might be counterproductive.
I'm unaware of the, Chair Vigor Peterson, I'm unaware of any time frame that the EPA was going to work through. However, I would say that this would still be consistent. So I don't think with federal law, so I don't believe that the statute would actually have to be removed. It should remain consistent, even if EPA moves forward with biogenic CO2 emission rules.
Thank you. Okay, Rip Johnson.
Is there a way that this could help Oregon's ability to comply with the Section 111D carbon guidelines that will be coming out? Is it possible that that could make it easier for us to comply with whatever those regulations end up being ultimately?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association believes so because it sets a state policy mm-hmm. on the use of biomass for activities like that. And we believe that it aligns with the state of Oregon comments that were submitted to the EPA on the rulemaking. And if you reference Janet McCabe's memo, it does say that they will they do believe in a state's ability to chart their own course.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you both very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on Senate Bill 752? Not seeing anybody jump up, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 752. And let's, do we have everybody here? Let's go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 319A. Beth, could you give us a reminder of this bill?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 319 was heard in committee on May 12th. It's the bill that would exempt ocean renewable energy facilities from regulation as a hydro project, as they are now, and require the Department of State Lands to develop a proprietary authorization to construct or operate an ocean renewable energy facility in the territorial sea. There's a revenue statement that was issued, which is indeterminate, and a minimal fiscal impact statement.
Okay, thank you. And no amendments for this
no
one,
amendments,
correct?
Correct?
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Johnson?
Do you have the script?
No, I didn't. Just winging it. So,
good. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 319A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves Senate Bill 319A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. And Rep. Boone, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
All right. Rep. Boone will carry it.
Now I object.
The motion passes. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 319A. And let's open. Are you good on time? Okay. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill
263A.
And Beth, do you want to give us a summary of that bill?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 263A was heard on May 5th. This is the bill that would expand the program options that cities and counties have to provide opportunities for recycling and waste prevention and update the solid waste recovery goals. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. And there is a dash, A5 amendment.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move to adopt the dash 5 amendments dated 5/14/15.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Johnson moves to adopt the dash A5 amendment dated 5/14/15. Is there any discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just, for the committee, there was some question in our testimony or in our committee meeting initially or in our hearing regarding the expansion of the quote-unquote opportunity for multifamily dwellings to be covered within this to offer the ability for them to engage in recycling. And there was, I think Representative Bitz's line of questioning was saying that, well, one man's opportunity could become another man's liability, so increased cost, how is that going to affect? So worked closely with Palmer at the DEQ and got some language back here that does say that in the reporting mechanism that will come back to us, I believe, in 2019, it says specifically that an evaluation of the costs of implementing multi-tenant recycling within the urban growth boundaries of cities with population of 4,000 or more that do not have fully have not fully implemented multi-tenant recycling. So I think there will be just a reporting back. Are there any unfortunate or unforeseen impacts on multifamily owners? So I feel really good about that, and hats off to Palmer for his help on the amendment.
Okay, and thank you for moving forward with with getting this drafted. This is taking the report that was already in the initial bill and adding an additional component to it. And we did check in with the stakeholders on this bill and who were happy with the changes. Okay, is there any further discussion on this bill? Okay. On moving the -85 amendment. Okay, any objection to moving the -85 amendment? Seeing none, the motion passes.
Chair Baker Peterson, I move Senate Bill 263A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves Senate Bill 263A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the bill?
Madam Chair, I will probably be a no on this. I understand what they're trying to do and everything, but I think our recycling programs, everything work well now. I'd like to see more as words tailored just to the city of Portland, because it sounds like an issue they have rather than making it as wide as it is. So. But I appreciate Representative Johnson's work and Palmer's work on this to make it a more palatable bill.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Hunt. Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Excused.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
No.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reardon.
Aye.
Chair Baker Peterson.
Aye. With that, the motion passes, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 6.
Senate carrier.
Oh, yes. Representative Johnson will carry the bill.
What about? And, I had the vote. I should be the carrier.
Actually, did you want to carry it?
I don't have a particular issue. Yeah. I would be happy to if you'd like.
Why don't we let Representative Reardon carry it so he can? Yep. All right, that's wonderful. So Representative Reardon will carry it, and with that, I will then close the work session and Senate Bill 263A. All right, thank you. And let's go ahead and. We're still working on amendments on
259.
Senate Bill 259. So I'm going to go ahead and carry that one over until Tuesday. So let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 829A. And Beth, do you want to let us give us a little introduction on that bill, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 829A would require the Department of Environmental Quality to take certain actions when developing or selecting among methodologies to assess waters of the state pursuant to the Federal Clean Water Act. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you so much, Beth. And it looks like we just have a couple people to testify. Heath Curtis. See, there you are. Come on down. Mm-hmm. Hi, welcome. Please go ahead and get started when you're ready.
Representative Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And Senate Bill 829 is a bill we support. It was adopted without opposition in the Senate committee and on the floor, and is before you today in its amended form. To make a long story as short as possible, and I've talked to many of you about this already, The Environmental Quality Commission adopts water quality standards, and the Clean Water Act requires them to do that. And once you adopt a water quality standard, the DEQ then sets about determining whether Oregon's water bodies meet water quality standards or not. Sometimes there's a trick in implementing water quality standards. That is to say, it's not always obvious how the water quality standard is supposed to be applied to any given individual water body. And so, to answer that question, DEQ publishes, along with its biennial report that includes the list of impaired water bodies, a methodology document that explains how they are applying water quality standards. And it's really a necessary exercise. What's challenging is that in recent years, the DEQ has set about applying rather broad water quality standards and developing parameters for those, and specifically benchmarks for what those broad water quality standards mean. So this is all kind of hypothetical, and I have to apologize, it's kind of a pointy-headed exercise in Clean Water Act law, but I handed out to you some materials, and they're on Willis, and I also have printed copies with the committee assistant, but one good example would be the Biocriteria standard. The Biocriteria standard was adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission and approved by the EPA. This is a water quality standard, and it says waters of the state must be of sufficient quality to support aquatic species without detrimental changes in the resident biological communities. Now, this isn't like a temperature standard where it says 16 degrees Celsius is the water quality standard, and if you're above 16 degrees Celsius, you know you are an exceedance of the water quality standard. Here, we just know that the water has to be of sufficient quality to support aquatic species. So I don't actually know what that means. Neither does DEQ for sure, but they set about trying to define it in their methodology document. And you'll see in their 2012 methodologies, this first appeared in 2010, but in the handout, you'll see four pages of text, including biocriteria assessment benchmarks included on the final page. Those benchmarks set certain numeric thresholds for purposes of assessing whether or not water bodies are of sufficient quality to support resident biological communities. Well, that's not really a scientific call, right? That's not the same as figuring out how you measure copper in a water body. This is determining what is okay and what's not okay in terms of, in this case, benthic macroinvertebrates in the stream. That to us is a policy call, and that is a policy call that appropriately involves policymakers like the Environmental Quality Commission. Our initial draft of this bill would have provided that methodology, the entire methodology document, would have to be adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission as a rule. We thought that that was the most appropriate way to put it before the Environmental Quality Commission. DEQ raised some good questions. You know, it's not clear if, in fact, the methodologies were adopted by rule, whether EPA would consider those to be water quality standards themselves. That may not only invoke EPA review, but it may also invoke federal litigation on these methodology documents, and I don't know that anybody wants to go that direction. So as an alternative in the Dash A amendments, we kind of resolved to create a public process. So if this bill were adopted, DEQ would have to publish a draft of its methodologies and solicit technical and scientific input. They would also have to solicit a public comment, and there would also be a hearing before the Environmental Quality Commission where the public and relevant scientists could weigh in prior to applying the methodologies to any water bodies when assessing whether or not they're impaired vis-a-vis the water quality standard. So while the Environmental Quality Commission wouldn't be making an affirmative decision vis-a-vis these the methodology document, they would, however, be able to provide input and express to DEQ where they thought they got it right or wrong, as could the public. I think that that would produce a better product. It's also important to note that the bill, as drafted, does not actually change any of the obligations of the EQ or the Environmental Quality Commission in terms of whether they have to adopt something by rule or not. We don't intend to change the obligations under Chapter 183. So with that, I realize it's a rather dry topic, but it's important to us. Seeing numeric thresholds for biocriteria appear for the first time in this methodology document, in our view, without robust public or scientific input, we think is wrong, and we think that Senate Bill 829 would go a long way toward fixing that, and we would commend it to your approval.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Heath?
Madam Chair, do we have other folks signed up to speak?
We do. We're going to hear from DEQ after this,
right,
too. Okay. Any questions? I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So, it says in your letter, numeric thresholds are not strictly scientific assessments. But at a certain point, don't we have to use numbers to say whether there's a certain water quality, impact on what's happening because of that? And the best way to do that is using numeric information?
Yes. Madam Chair, I agree. I actually think that's true. However, in almost every other circumstance I'm aware, those numeric thresholds are themselves water quality standards and adopted by rule by the Environmental Quality Commission. That is to say, I actually like numeric thresholds because they give me a right answer to whether the stream is impaired or not, or whether I'm contributing to impairment or not. The question isn't whether we should have numeric thresholds. The question is who's the right decision maker, right? And how are those thresholds derived? We had thought initially that the right decision maker is the Environmental Quality Commission and that they should be adopted as water quality standards formally. In this case, it may be that an acceptable answer is that the Department of Environmental Quality can set numeric thresholds in the form of benchmarks. However, if that's going to be the case, then it certainly demands public input and an opportunity for comment, much like if it were a rule. That is to say, what would be unfortunate is if those numeric thresholds were crafted without an opportunity for public input, that is not like a rule.
Okay. Okay. Well, no, and then I just... It brings up as part of it in a very rule-like manner of getting input from other sources, scientific and technical input. I'm assuming the people that we have at DEQ are themselves scientific and technical experts in some of the areas where they're working in.
That is emphatically true, and some of the best scientists in the state, I would say. However, it would be a big ask of the regulated community to say, just trust the DEQ scientists got it right. That is to say, we have numerous examples where our input has produced a better product. And I think that DEQ would agree with that, and they'll be up next. But I think input from the regulated community is an appropriate and important component of developing these kinds of thresholds, whether adopted as rules or benchmarks in the methodology document.
Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Brent, I'm not trying to put you on the spot at all, but you may be more up to speed on this than me. Didn't mind me in a different, in a slightly different theater. Didn't EPA's TMDLs get partially invalidated recently? For being essentially arbitrary.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Helm, it may be, I don't know the entire universe of TMDL litigation, but I know quite a bit of it. It may be that you're talking about the Acosta decision, which called into question the use of the natural conditions criterion as a component of the temperature standard. And we could take a deep dive on the temperature standard if you like, but know that the TMDLs themselves, the temperature TMDLs themselves, are the subject of litigation right now, and there's been no decision on those as of yet. That said, a really fundamental component of how they derived those TMDLs, that is to say the temperatures that they were actually trying to meet, was the natural conditions criterion that was overturned by Judge Acosta, calling into question whether TMDLs like that could be crafted in the future.
Great. Thank you. That helps me.
Okay. I'm glad it helps you, Representative Helm. Representative Rudin.
Acronym alert.
Right.
What is a TMDL?
Total maximum daily load of pollutants.
Okay. I don't use the term every day.
I'm sorry.
I recognize it now. But
to talk
you.
And cut.
I don't ever use it.
It's dangerous to children.
Yeah. And lawyers.
One. Do all scientists always agree on their findings?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon, emphatically no. I think it's, though, precisely for that reason that solicitation of scientific input is important in this circumstance. That is to say, because they don't agree, I think they can, however, respect one another's opinion, and I'm optimistic that input would provide for a better product.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thanks, and maybe DEQ could answer this, but so what's changing under this bill is that instead of DEQ making this decision about what the right methodologies are, after all this input coming in through a public process at the EQC, the EQC is actually going to make the decision. Have I got that wrong? Or is the DEQ going to make the decision at the end of the day?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Holvey, as the bill is drafted, this would create a process that does not exist today for public input and for solicitation of scientific input. But ultimately, as drafted, the decision would still be in the form of guidance adopted by the Department of Environmental Quality. There would be a hearing before the Environmental Quality Commission, and the EQC would provide input on development of the methodologies, but they would not be approved formally or adopted as rules by the Environmental Quality Commission.
Follow up. So the Department of Environmental Quality wouldn't be obligated to follow the EQC regulation, or not the regulation, the EQC recommendation?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Holvey, I think strictly legally, yes, that's true. I find it unlikely. That is to say, it seems unlikely to me that the DEQ staff would put together a methodology document over the objection of their commission. But I don't really see this going down in quite that manner. That is to say, I don't see the Environmental Quality Commission adopting a preferred outcome vis-a-vis the methodologies. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be an opportunity for the public to say their piece and for commission members to provide input to DEQ and development of these, you know, methodologies.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way I understand this, all you're after is being able to bring in other scientists to, the way I see it, is benefit and help DEQ in their decision-making process to where there's more brain trust coming to the table rather than just relying on the few scientists that they have, but bring other people to the table to help them get to the point that we need to make sure we have the cleanest water that we can?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Widener, that's accurate. I think that's one half of the answer. I would also say that implicit in setting numeric thresholds is a policy call, right, about the way we want waters in the state to look and what is and is not impaired. And in that context, I also think that public input, that is to say not necessarily just scientific input, but public input on that policy call is appropriate. So, yes, the answer is I do think that all this is a process to help DEQ produce a better product. It does not fundamentally change the structure of how they're doing business.
And
follow up.
So that's the first part that I see. Next is, giving you a definitive answer, this is where we have to be, so the target's not kind of adjusting and moving on you, so it makes it easier for industry to, okay, this is what we have to do to get it to this level and make it faster for you implementing and putting in your water quality system for any drainage that you have.
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Widener, I would say that that's right. I struggle some with numeric benchmarks in the methodology document and how precisely those work. There's another one in the turbidity parameter presently that we struggle with. But speaking in the abstract, generally, yeah, we like to know the right answer, and we like deriving precisely where we need to be instead of having amorphous and ambiguous standards that, you know, are difficult to apply.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
So, but the numeric, it also allows you, when the outside parties come in, what's an acceptable to release that might be a higher numeric versus what's unacceptable to be released that should be in lower numeric, so then you can put in the proper systems for it. And I think that's where bringing in outside scientists would help tremendously, would it not?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Widener, I agree.
Yeah. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Hey, that's fun. Thanks.
Next, we're going to call Palmer Mason and Jennifer Weigel from DEQ. Well, I'm sure we'll have more questions for you, so thank you.
Good Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. We're obviously here on Senate Bill 829. I just want to put on the record that the department is neutral on the bill, but we did work with the stakeholders to come upon some agreed upon language that works for us, and that's what you see in the bill. And I just want to share that. And I will note, just for the record, that there were no TMDLs harmed in the amending of this bill.
Thank you.
And Jennifer is here in case you have any technical questions that I can't answer. And Jennifer is the water quality policy coordinator at the department.
Great, thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer or Palmer, whichever one of you wants this, but the questions I was getting at earlier, do you see this as something that's beneficial for you and helping you bring in extra eyes and ears just to help you come to some of the conclusions and dealing with some of the issues that you have?
Chair Vega and Representative Widener, where I see this, we had planned to do, we had recognized we needed additional public process into this separate from this bill coming forward. We recognized we did not do a good job of that in the past. In our other water quality programs, we do, we have employed outside scientific experts in developing various methodologies, scientific approaches, et cetera. So that is not a practice that's new to DEQ, to go beyond our own scientific and technical expertise. This provides a more systematic and predictable way in which we would do that. And so we think that it would be in line with our expectations for how we would run this process.
And I might add, too, Madam Chair and Representative Widener, I agree with some of what was said here a moment ago about the concerns about defining a narrative standard and that might be infused with policy considerations. So in working on this bill, it seemed to us that there was a balance that could be struck between going through the rulemaking progress and, as Heath pointed out, taking the risk that EPA would deem that a water quality standard and expose DEQ, and I might add by extension the taxpayer, to a whole lot more litigation around that, and then doing what we were doing today. And the balance could be struck by having the EQC provide some input to the department as we develop the assessment methodology, and that seemed to be the right balance to be found, and we worked with him and the other stakeholders to get there.
If I follow up comment, Palmer, Jennifer, I mean, I commend you for being neutral on this, because I think this is going to be extremely beneficial for you and your determinations and things, because it's going to bring both sides together and everybody's going to see this is good, this is good, this is good, and then we have disagreement here, and everybody knows that process, and it helps you dig deeper and truly come out with a better product in the end, I think. So I commend you for not being able to come here support, but to be neutral on this, because I think it's going to make your department much more functional.
Representative Holvey.
Thanks. I guess I'm going to ask you the same question. I see the process and the public input is very beneficial as well. You know, it's always nice to get as much science as you can to consider issues. I guess my question is really about, you know, how this process plays out, and you're actually making a scientific determination at the end of the day, and after hearing that, going through this public process and having the EQC weighing in on that as well and making a recommendation on what your decision should be, is it actually allowing the EQC to make the scientific decision instead of the Department of Environmental Quality? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
Yes. Chair Vega, Peterson, and Representative Holvey. In terms of how we're seeing it playing out, in thinking through this, we've played that scenario through. How does this go? One, we fully expect on some issues that we wouldn't have necessarily scientific agreement. But what we could get from this process is, particularly going through a scientific peer review process as an example, what you often get is an understanding of where you have some weaknesses and strengths in varying approaches. Not any, I would say, in most cases when we do this kind of approach and work with different scientists, I don't know any scientist ever tells you that anything is 100% perfect for the application that you're trying to do. So what this process could give us through that kind of peer review and input process is understanding, given the particular application that we are looking to apply it to, what are the strengths and weaknesses of various approaches that could be used? Are they scientifically valid? And understanding if we have three methods in front of us that might be viable, we would choose method two, because on balance, given its application, given the kind of data sets we're looking at, et cetera, we feel that that's the most defensible approach. And it gives us more information about the varying perspectives and what might be limitations, really, of applying one over the other. In terms of our interaction with the commission, I would view that as a way of, when we go to our commission, it's in the agency's best interest, and it's in the commission's best interest that we be well prepared to develop our recommendations and to be able to say why we chose a particular method over another one, and to have a good documentation for what we considered and why we decided what we decided. And I think that's also where DEQ's our own scientists and technical experts come in, as being able to fully evaluate and understand the input that we've gotten in, and being able to apply our own scientific principles in making that final decision. The commission may disagree with that based on other input, but I think that kind of a process puts us on the spot for really being well prepared for that kind of interaction with our commission.
Follow up. So I appreciate that answer. I guess my answer is, what if the EQC, the commission, decided we prefer methodology two, and they're telling you that, and your opinion was that after looking at all the science, all the input, you wanted methodology one. What would be the result of something like that? I mean, what would you do? Do you follow the EQC, or do you follow your own scientist opinion?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, on the outset, I don't know that we would ever reach that level of just stark disagreement. It's possible, and we may have to cross that bridge when we get there. I think what Jennifer is sharing with you is all of these questions have a level of uncertainty. Sometimes it's lower, sometimes it's higher. And if we're in a situation where the uncertainty is higher than normal or higher than expected, then through the public process, potentially the peer review, and then the discussion with the EQC, we've tried to illuminate that uncertainty. We've tried to illuminate the trade-offs between the different options, what the science tells us about the different options to assess the quality of the water. I think that gives the EQC the ability to indicate to us that they may have a preference, or they want us to explore option A more closely than options B and C, for instance. And I think that's the sort of dialogue and interaction that we're expecting to happen out of this process. But I suppose there could be just a disagreement between the staff and the commission. I'll tell you, as the EQ person, that's not really where we want to be. It's kind of an uncomfortable spot. So I don't think I see that happening all that often, just that total stark disagreement. Hopefully that helps.
Representative Hull.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you been able to get any opinion from your attorneys whether this gives you additional legal insulation from potential challenges to these very same standards?
I'll go ahead. Yeah.
So it may be early to try to do that.
Right. Yeah. Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Helm, we of course have consulted with our attorneys in terms of worked with stakeholders to develop amendments to ensure that what we are proposing fit within both our Clean Water Act responsibilities as well as state requirements. So in that realm, we feel very comfortable with them. And in terms of insulating over litigation, frankly, actually, most of the litigation that occurs within this program would be more likely to happen at the federal level. EPA has an oversight authority in terms of how we run this program. And so if there were to be legal challenges, it would likely happen within the federal court more often than in state court.
Okay.
Follow up.
Thanks for that information. And the reason that I ask is, I like this transparency process for the very reason that it does give the additional input, and to Representative Holvey's question about where you end up. And the additional process gives the department the flexibility to resolve as an agency the battle of the experts. And as long as you have a robust process to do that, typically courts will defer to the agency's expertise and their choice of experts. So to the question of whether this strengthens your program, I really think it has that potential to do so. It's a good idea.
Okay. And just, I would just add my voice to those. I think the added transparency and input on this is a good thing. But as anything, when you add complexity to a process, it takes longer. Do you have any estimates right now of what this might do to the length of time in going through the process of creating these methodologies?
Right. So, Chair Vega Peterson, when we prepared the fiscal, we did not specify that there would be any additional impact. We are embarking on a process by which we intend to do a significant revision to how we approach developing our assessment of water quality. And as I mentioned earlier, getting some increased transparency and input on how we develop these methods was our intention and is a priority for us. The one piece that is added to this is a loop through the commission, so it may take some additional time. Our commission meets approximately 5 to 6 times a year, so just in terms of their own timing, that could put some delay, but not significant in terms of how we approach the overall preparation of our assessment.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? No. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Anybody else here to testify on this bill? Seeing nobody standing up, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 829A. And I believe I already mentioned that we're carrying over the work session for 259A till Tuesday, May 26th. And if no one has anything else, I will go ahead and close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you. Close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you.